move to the second case this morning, U.S. versus Adams. Mr. Paul.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Mr. Adams has been sentenced to serve the rest of his life in prison based on a conviction that rests at least in part on arrests relating to crimes not at issue in this case, and based on the testimony of witnesses he never got to cross-examine. Mr. Adams should get a new trial. One of the government's principal themes throughout the trial was that Adams had a propensity to deal in drugs. From the first day of the trial through the closing arguments, the government pressed this theme. There were 14 witnesses put on in total by the government, and five of those witnesses were exclusively devoted to testifying about prior arrests. And one of those witnesses, one additional witness, her testimony was partly devoted to testifying about a prior arrest. This testimony, in turn, led to more bad acts testimony. Four of the police officers testified not only to arrests or stops, but as to prior police contacts or the fact that they knew Adams. And one officer testified that following the June 1, 06 arrest, that he conducted an interview of Adams, and that interview in turn produced a number of damaging statements, including that Mr. Adams was a lifelong crack cocaine user and that he had never held a job. Then in the closing argument, the government started out by listing the dates on which Mr. Adams had been arrested prior to the ultimate arrest at issue in this case, and it emphasized the fact that he had contact with the police. You heard that every time the defendant had contact with the police, there were two things: large amounts of money and crack cocaine. That's what the government said in its closing argument, and then it later repeated the fact that Mr. Adams had contact with the police.
Well, isn't the big problem you have here the fact that no motion in limine was filed? I mean, as I understand the record, counsel, you've acknowledged having received 404B notice from the government, and was there a motion in limine or discussions about introduction of this evidence?
There was no motion in limine, Your Honor. However, there are three arrests at issue, and they were all objected to by defense counsel. Two of the arrests, the 02 arrest and the 04 arrest, were specifically objected to on relevancy grounds. And in responding to those objections, the government specifically made a 404B argument. Mm-hmm. So this court has held in United States versus Joseph, it's a case cited in our briefs, that if it's clear in context what the purpose or the nature of the objection is, then that objection is preserved. And certainly, at least as to two of the arrests, the government understood that we were making a 404B objection when we objected on relevancy grounds. Now, the government attempts to justify the admission of this evidence primarily on the intricately related evidence doctrine, and the theory being that these prior arrests, these prior crimes, are just part of the conspiracy at issue in this case. This court only recently, however,
said... Let me just go back to that relevance objection, because when the government did respond with 404B, counsel was asked for any response to the proffer that the government offered, he just acknowledged the notice and just relied on the previous objection, didn't really point out problems with the 404B proffer.
That's true.
Is that a correct reading?
No, you're correct. He did make a simple relevance objection. One other thing I might note on that point is just last year, in a case called Gallo-Moreno, this court noted that there might be an intra-circuit split on the question of whether a relevancy objection is enough to preserve a 404B objection. The other thing I would note is that this court, even if the standard of review is plain error, it has reversed and sent back cases for new trials on a plain error standard when you're talking about a 404B issue, the most recent case that I can think of is United States versus Simpson, which is also cited in our brief. One of the critical problems with the government relying on this evidence is that it never bothered to try to connect up the prior arrests to the conspiracy at issue. It never showed, for example, that the drugs or the money seized as a part of those arrests were the fruits of the conspiracy. Its theory was just because the defendant has been arrested with money and drugs during the time frame of the conspiracy, that evidence is ipso facto evidence of the conspiracy. But the problem with that is, as demonstrated by the O2 arrest, that that's not necessarily the case. The government, Mr. Adams was arrested in O2, and he was found to have a significant amount of crack cocaine and money on him. The government justified the admission of that evidence primarily on the grounds that it was evidence of the conspiracy because it occurred within the time frame of the conspiracy. The problem with that theory is it's uncontradicted that Mr. Adams' alleged co-conspirators did not meet Mr. Adams until 2 years after that arrest, in 2004. The government cites a case called Zarns for the proposition that evidence of arrests involving possession of drugs and money during the time frame of the alleged conspiracy is probative of the conspiracy. But if you look at the case that Zarn cites, and which the government also cites in its brief, a case called Wells, it says that it's admissible assuming the government connects it up, assuming the government connects up the prior arrest to the conspiracy at issue.
Mr. Paul, let me ask you, was it not Mr. Adams' defense in this case that he was a crack user as opposed to a distributor?
Yes, Your Honor.
And then wouldn't that evidence be of the prior convictions be relevant to establishing that his possession was for the purpose of distribution?
A couple points on that. First of all of these prior arrests did not involve, there was no evidence that any of these prior arrests involved charges or convictions for intent to distribute. They were all simple possession charges. That's number one. Number two, even assuming relevance, the court is still obligated to go through a 404B weighing process. The 404B is a rule of exclusion. It's not a rule of admission. It says that prior bad acts may be admissible to show intent, knowledge, planning, purpose, and so on. The court has to still decide whether the probative value of that evidence is outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, and the court just simply never did that in this case.
And, of course, there was no request for the court to do that.
Yes, again.
And no request for limiting instructions.
Yes, you're correct.
On how this testimony should be viewed by the jury.
Correct. The only objections that were made were relevance objections. But, again, the government did bring up 404B, and the court certainly at that point should have understood that there was a 404B problem, and it has to then consider whether the probative value outweighs whether the probative value is outweighed by the risk of unfair prejudice. Now, regardless of the standard of review, we have to deal with the problem of whether this was all just harmless error or whether it affected the substantial rights, and it did. And here's why. As I said, there were 14 witnesses who testified, 7 police officers and 7 civilians. Of the 7 civilians who testified, 6 of those 7 civilians were testifying under cooperation agreements. All of the alleged co-conspirators were testifying under cooperation agreements. And why is that significant? It's significant because this court said in a case called Owens that when the government's star witnesses are primarily people testifying in exchange for a reduced sentence, the average juror is likely to look elsewhere for evidence to corroborate their testimony. And in that event, the defendant's alleged bad acts may very well take on a central role in the jury's deliberation. Well, the only place that the jury had to go to look for evidence corroborating the civilian testimony is to the police officers, 5 of whom, again, whose testimony was devoted almost exclusively or exclusively to Adams' prior bad acts. The other reason it wasn't harmless error is that if Officer Galt's testimony about the 06 arrest had been excluded, there would have been no occasion for him to testify about the interview that immediately followed that arrest in which Adams made a number of incriminating statements. that probably or very well could have weighed significantly in the jury's mind. Now, if I could, I'd like to turn to the Confrontation Clause issue very briefly. There are two statements at issue, and the question as to both is whether they were offered for their truth, whether they were hearsay, or whether they were simply offered for foundational or contextual reasons. The government says the latter. It says, we simply allowed these officers to testify as to confidential source statements to explain why those officers did what they did. But if you look at the testimony, the confidential source statements were totally unnecessary for that purpose. First, Officer Broderson's statement. He said that on the date of Adams' ultimate arrest, he received a call from a confidential source who said that Adams had just left William Neal's residence. William Neal is the alleged ringleader of this conspiracy, and that Adams had drugs on him and that he had been arrested. Based on that, Broderson went down to the booking room, conducted a search of Adams, and ultimately recovered the crack cocaine at issue in this case. The jury did not need to hear the confidential source statements to understand why Officer Broderson might have conducted a search of Mr. Adams. A jury understands that that's what happens when you're arrested. You're searched. In fact, the problem with this evidence is that it didn't serve as contextual evidence. It served as substantive evidence because it directly tied Mr. Adams to the alleged ringleader of the conspiracy, Mr. Neal.
Well, actually, when Broderson went to the cell, he never conducted a search of him, didn't he? Did he? Because wasn't the evidence already out?
No, he came down to the booking room, conducted a search. He wanted Mr. Adams to show him his backside. Mr. Adams refused to do that.
Right.
Yeah, and then the crack cocaine was recovered.
Okay.
The second statement is came from Officer Gault. And what happened there was that Officer Gault testified that his partner, Officer Broderson, had received a call from a confidential source on June 1st, 2006, about 2 weeks before the ultimate arrest, saying that Adams was on his way to buy drugs and that he had a bunch of money on him. Gault, knowing that Adams did not have a driver's license, went out on patrol, saw Adams driving down the street, and pulled him over. Again, the jury did not need to hear the confidential source statement to understand why Officer Gault might have pulled over Adams. All they needed to hear at most was that Officer Gault knew that Adams did not have a driver's license, and he pulled him over. They didn't need to hear the confidential source statement. There was no claim that Adams was being unfairly targeted. And this evidence, by the way, served a substantive purpose, too, because according to the confidential source, Adams was a person who was, quote, involved in drugs. Now, in the context of a trial for conspiracy, a jury could take that any number of ways. Does that mean that Adams is simply a user? Does it mean he's a dealer? Or does it mean that he's involved in a conspiracy? So the admission of both of these statements was in violation of the Confrontation Clause. I see that I've moved into my rebuttal. Thank you.
I think your time has expired, but I'll give you a minute.
Thank you.
Mr. Arthur?
Good morning, Your Honor. I don't think that the standard review will decide this case, but I appreciate your interest in it, and I'd like to just address for a moment the manner, the chronology in which the evidence was produced. The evidence of the first possession of drugs and bundled cash was the defendant's possession in 2006. That's the chronology of the trial. So I think it was the second witness in the trial. The first and the second witness testified about a 2006 incident. And that's the one, Judge Williams, in which all the defense attorney said was objection. There's no reference to relevance, hearsay, or anything of the sort. And the oddity of the transcript is that after the objection, the single word objection is made to that evidence, then the witness proceeded to testify. Who knows what happened on the record, or in the courtroom, I should say. On the record, it's perfectly clear. So at least for the 2006 arrest, the one in which they object because that's the one after which Mr. Adams made statements, clearly that one must be reviewed on a plain error standard. The other thing about the 2006 incident is that the statements that Mr. Adams made were just referred to as highly incriminating, but of course the statements he made were that he is a drug addict, he's a drug user, and he carries a crack cocaine pipe with him wherever he goes. And so that was really his ready defense, obviously, throughout this period of his dealing. He was ready. I think you saw every time he was stopped by the police that he had a crack pipe with him, and his position at trial was he's not going to take the witness stand because his statement to the police that he's a drug addict was already in. That was not incriminating evidence. That was supportive of his defense. So that's the chronologically in the trial, that's the first piece of evidence that came in. And I think that my opposing counsel has done a nice job to try to portray these arrests as convictions. And in fact, Your Honor, I believe you even referred to them as convictions a moment ago. And they weren't convictions. We happen to know that they were convictions only because of the stipulation to the periods of incarceration. I mean, Mr. Adams stipulated to 12 different periods of incarceration, so it's a little odd that you can now come in and portray these simple arrests as being highly prejudicial, so prejudicial that there was a miscarriage of justice in the police introducing them. I mean, there are 12 periods of incarceration, and I think that if the jury were to have fit it all together, you would see that some of the periods of incarceration follow immediately upon the dates of arrest. So obviously, you know, something happened, and he likely was convicted of those various possessions. But the focus on the arrests, I think, is really unfair and misleading in terms of the nature of this evidence. Yes, each time it occurred, the police did, in fact, arrest him. One of them was for a traffic offense, for driving without a license. The real point of this evidence was that during the period of a charged conspiracy, Mr. Adams possessed distribution quantities of crack cocaine and or bundled cash that was bundled in the way that drug dealers presented. So, from the government's position, and I hope this is perfectly clear in our brief, when a grand jury charges a defendant with conspiracy to distribute drugs during a period of time, we're going to produce evidence that proves the defendant either distributed drugs during that period of time, possessed distribution amounts of drugs during that period of time, or possessed large quantities of unexplained cash bundled as a drug distributor.
Now, did the amount of the quantity of drugs he possessed come into evidence?
Yes. Yes, the first time it was 6 grams. The second time was a smaller amount. It was 1 point. I'm saying not the second time it came into evidence. The second time chronologically was that May 18th of 2004 incident where the woman, Laurel Smith, had called the police and he was on his way to distribute drugs to her, as you recall. That was the smaller amount, 1.6 grams, and the smaller amount of cash, $290. But the third time, when he was arrested on June 1st, he didn't have cash. He didn't have any drugs. He just had the $1,800 of bundled cash. And the point is really that we're not relying on inextricably intertwined. I know there's a reference to a recited case that indicates why evidence can be introduced for reasons other than Rule 404B, but we're not relying on inextricably intertwined evidence in this case. This is direct evidence of a conspiracy.
And then you're covering the entire period from 01 to 06, even though he didn't meet his co-conspirators until 04.
Even though the evidence proved he did not meet these co-conspirators until later. The grand jury charged that the conspiracy began in 2001. Now, you raise an interesting collateral issue as to when the conspiracy that was proven actually started. But that wasn't an issue when this evidence was introduced. What the district court judge had in front of him at the time was an indictment that charged a period of time for a conspiracy. And the issue is, does evidence of a possession of distribution amounts of drugs during that period of charged conspiracy, is that evidence admissible? And I think the answer is clearly yes. Now, ultimately, we find out that the main co-conspirators, Williams, Gibson, and Wilson, or not Neil, Gibson, and Wilson, the main co-conspirators people who were people who were distributing to him, he didn't even meet until 2003, I believe. Was it? Yes, I understand that. But the question for the district court judge when this evidence was introduced is it admissible to prove up a conspiracy during this period of time that the grand jury? And by the way, the argument that you're suggesting or implying is not an argument that's made by defense counsel that somehow this was outside the period of the charged conspiracy. It was clearly within the period. All three were clearly within the period of the charged conspiracy. And our position is, well, evidence of distribution of drugs or possession, distribution quantities of drugs during a period of a conspiracy is overt acts in furtherance of the conspiracy. I mean, had we charged this as a 371, a Title 18 371 conspiracy in which we had detailed the overt acts, some of this evidence probably would have been detailed as an overt act. But this was a Title 21-846 conspiracy where we don't need to prove the overt acts. And I don't think – I think we allege some very general overt acts, if any at all.
Well, can you address counsel's argument about the confidential informant's statements, and specifically the one where I think it's Frederickson goes down to the cell and he finds the crack cocaine in his hat, and then he finds these other two packets. You know, counsel's position is, why is that? Why was all the detail that the CI provided necessary? Why did that have to be admitted? Because he was already in jail, and so obviously the police had the right to search him.
I don't know. That was just a mistake. That shouldn't have been. I think that they could have said, I spoke to a confidential informant or not, especially with that particular incident. I went down to the jail, explained what he did. I don't know why that confidential source's information was laid out on the record and then used in closing argument.
Because it was used a couple times. You know, the rationale was, this sort of explains why the officers did what they did, but they had the right to go into that cell and search him. So
right, or even to have said, I spoke to a confidential source, and as a result of that conversation, then I did such and such.
Right, but that's normally the way it's done.
It's normally.
I mean, it's certainly the cleaner way is to do it that way, the way to avoid questions in oral argument or issues in a trial.
I'm glad that we agree. Yes, I mean that's unfortunate, but. Again, the reason I say that I don't think that deciding the standard review, although important for us, which I'll mention in a moment, is going to decide the case is because, I mean, let's face it, this is the overwhelming evidence in this case. So that was mistake was made. I thought that Judge Williams, the bigger mistake, was referring to it as though it was substantive evidence in closing argument. I mean, it could arguably have been foundational. It should have been trimmed down dramatically, as you and I just discussed. I thought that the Broderson testimony was a little more detailed than the second one that simply explained why the officer was going to the flower shop, I think, because is that the one where Laurel Smith had given him information?
Right.
That was not used in closing argument. That was clearly substantially less prejudicial.
And then on this 404B, once it was clear that 404B was one of the areas that the government was relying upon to get that, even though defense counsel didn't request that the court make a specific finding as to why it qualified under 404B, certainly the government can request the court to make a finding if evidence is being admitted under that theory. You agree with that?
Oh, yes. Yes, I don't.
I mean, it doesn't have to be prompted by defense.
Right.
Defense counsel. I know we're, you know.
Yes.
We're in the serious error land here because there was no objection. But I'm just saying, for purposes of the record, having the court make that finding would be helpful.
You know, I think we disagree on this. This is not 404B evidence, and we would not consider this as a 404B evidence in the case. And I think they've done a nice job of trying to cram this square peg into a round hole by repeatedly saying this is 404B, 404B. Our view is that this is direct evidence of the conspiracy. This is evidence of acts in furtherance of the conspiracy that we very likely would have charged as overt acts had we written or drafted a speaking.
So your position is it wasn't necessary because that really wasn't the principal reason that you were relying on in terms of the admissibility of this evidence, because it was part of the whole conspiracy.
That's absolutely correct. Okay. Right. I think that I've addressed all the points I wanted to make. If there are no further questions.
Well, the vouching issue.
Say it again?
The vouching issue.
Vouching for the witness.
Vouching.
Remember, the prosecutor vouched for that witness. I said I believe her, or I believe the witness.
Yeah, I hope our brief addresses that. It's just something that should never happen. Shouldn't have happened in this case. Mm-hmm. Hopefully won't be repeated. I hope never to be here again with that kind of issue. It's unfortunate. As all of you know, that in district court, during the course of trials, mistakes do happen. Sometimes we have perfect cases and perfect trials, and we have Anders briefs. And
well, we don't see too many perfect cases, but
No.
Thank you, counsel.
Sure. Thank you.
That's not our job, Mr. Hartzler, to find perfect cases.
And you have another minute, Mr. Paul.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very briefly, while the prior bad acts may be evidence of an intent to distribute, again, they were never connected up to the conspiracy at issue. And the government has to offer a connection at trial, because it's at that point that the district court has the opportunity to weed out the wheat from the chaff, and the government never gave the court that opportunity. And quickly on the confidential source statements, we didn't discuss standard of review, but it's de novo. And as to the one-word objection as to Galt's statement about the confidential source, the district court's response to that was, this evidence is not being offered for its truth. It's being offered only for foundational purposes, indicating that the district court clearly understood that objection as a hearsay objection. The evidence of Adams' police contacts did nothing more than cloak Adams before the jury in his prior crack cocaine arrests, and the confidential source statements were totally gratuitous. Mr. Adams should get a new trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Paul, you took this case by appointment, did you?
Yes.
Well, you have the appreciation of the court for your fine representation. You're fine. Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. We